Yeah, recently people have discovered that this invariant called the topological shift, it extends to systems with even discrete symmetry. It was known previously as the coefficient of the Wen-Z term. And so the question we wanted to ask is, are there sufficient conditions that in generic abelian symmetry enriched topological orders with either discrete or continuous rotation symmetry, can they protect edge modes? So specifically, I'll talk about a quantum Hall system where we take two systems which have the same Chern number. And so if I take these systems like this, then they have two counterpropagating edge modes, which generically would just, you'd be able to gap them out. But what I'll argue is that if they have different shift invariants, then these edge modes are protected and they cannot be gapped out. And then moving to the case of discrete symmetry, I'll show that if you take some abelian SET and you put it on the surface of a cube or some platonic solid, then it generically will have fractionalized corner charges. So you can think of this state as being a fractional higher order topological oscillator. Okay. So the outline, I'll start with some general background, move to the explicit example of the quantum Hall effect, which would just be a non-interacting example of this, then go to the general theory for abelian SETs, and then close with some open questions. Okay. So the general problem that a lot of us in this room have been interested in is that of quantum many-body topology, specifically the topology of gapped ground states of quantum many-body systems. So we know that topological phases display structured entanglement in the ground's many-body ground state. This leads to things like quantized responses, Hall conductance, etc., fractionalized excitations, anions in the bulk. And also you can think of these topological phases as furnishing resource states for quantum information tasks. So for example, SPT phases are known to be universal for many, can be used for many body quantum computation. So we can enrich topological phases by adding symmetries to the story. So if I have no symmetries and I look at the space of all gapped ground states of local Hamiltonians, I can split, we can split that up into different phases labeled by their intrinsic topological order. So the trivial phase has no topological order, and then you can label these other ones by their different TOs. So for example, G2H theory, fractional quantum Hall effect, etc. And then if we add symmetries, then even the trivial phase now splits up into different phases, which are distinguished by how symmetry acts on them. So you could have symmetry breaking phases, symmetry or symmetry protected topological phases with the AKLT chain being an instance of that. And then even the topologically ordered states can be enriched by symmetries, and these are what are called symmetry enriched topological phases. Okay. So yeah, for example, in the non-interacting case or even in the interacting case, you have topological insulators protected by some time reversal symmetry, or you can have Z2 gauge theory like the toric code, and you can enrich it by Z2 symmetry or U1 symmetry. So just so we're all on the same page, SPT phases are zero temperature gapped ground states, which in which the symmetry G is not spontaneously broken. The ground state is unique on any manifold, and there are no non-local excitations in the box, so there are no anions in SPT phases. And in a sense, all the interesting physics is on the edge, so you can have gapless edge modes in SPT phases, anomalous boundaries. So for example, the quantum spin-Hall insulator, band insulators, etc. And for systems with only internal symmetries, the classification is fairly well understood in two dimensions, in three dimensions, and the mathematical classification goes under group cohomology or cobordism in theory more generally. So now we can also look at topologically ordered phases. In the absence of any symmetry in 2+1 dimensions, topologically ordered phases are believed to be fully classified by unitary modular denser categories. But once we add symmetries on top of them, then you enrich them by some G symmetry. So here the ground state does support fractional excitations. You have non-trivial anion braiding in these topologically ordered states. And once you add a symmetry, now the symmetry can fractionalize non-trivially on these anions. So the anions can carry non-trivial symmetry charges. And in general, in 2+1D, these are also classified by what's called G-crossed braided denser category. And essentially what that does is it tells you how the symmetry defects in your symmetry, braid non-trivially with your anions. So it encodes that algebraically. But more generally, systems can also have not just internal symmetries, but spatial symmetries, so translation, rotations, and space group symmetry. And one can ask, how is the classification of topological phases changed or enriched once we add translation symmetries, or in more generally, space group symmetries to the story? And this has been a topic of active research. So the simplest example of this is just a weak topological phase, where I say take some two-dimensional, non-trivial topological states, and I just stack them. And in the, if these states are invertible and I don't have translation symmetry, I could just push them together and cancel them out. But if I have translation symmetry, then you're not allowed to do that anymore. So that's the simplest example. And so these things have been studied, topological crystalline phases have been studied a lot, especially in the non-interacting context, where people have found various examples. They've been found in experiment. And generically, these kinds of systems display edge modes, which are not just localized on the D minus one dimensional boundary of the system, but some lower dimensional submanifold. So for instance, you could have modes that are localized at the corners, or modes that are localized on the hinges in the three-dimensional system. And this, in the non-interacting case, has gone under the name of higher-order topological insulators. And the interacting case typically goes under the name of topological crystals.
Topological what?
Crystals, people usually call them.
Are they the examples of these?
In the interacting case?
Oh, I guess I meant with bulk topological order and crystalline symmetry. No.
Theoretically, yes, expand.
Okay.
Yes. Okay. V2, toric code enriched by translation symmetry, for instance. So in the general interacting setting, there's been a lot of work, especially by Dominic, in classifying these topological crystalline phases. And there's several approaches that people have taken. So one approach by Mike Hermele's group, for instance, is to consider taking, for invertible states specifically, taking some system with a crystalline symmetry. Since it's an SPD state, you can trivialize it away from the plane that preserves the space group symmetry. So for instance, if we have reflection symmetry, you can trivialize the state using a finite depth local unitary everywhere away from the reflection plane. And then all the topological properties of the state are encoded in this lower dimensional surface. And so that's one way that one can understand these topological crystalline phases in the general interacting system. So they have a classification based on that. And then Ryan Thorngren and Dominic have this beautiful picture for classifying topological crystalline phases based on gauging crystalline symmetries. So this is a very powerful approach, and I'll say a little bit more about that in a moment. And so far, all three approaches agree. And there's also real space classification for these topological crystalline phases, which provides a check on these different approaches. There's another approach that I'll quickly flag, which is encoding the topological response in the elasticity theory. So this is what that Dominic did, and then we also extended this to the case of quasicrystals, where you don't even necessarily have translation symmetry. And you can write down response theories for such systems. So the crystalline equivalence principle that Ryan and Dominic wrote down, essentially what it states is that if you want to talk about the classification of gap ground states of some system with a crystalline symmetry G, it's in one-to-one correspondence with topological phases with internal symmetry. So you basically treat that crystalline symmetry as being an internal symmetry and then do your classification. And this has been extended from bosonic systems to even fermionic systems, where it goes under the name of the fermionic crystalline equivalence principle. So in this case, you take your bosonic symmetry group, which is all the space group symmetries and the internal symmetries, that's G boson, and you think of the fermionic symmetry group as an extension of G boson by fermion parity. And so this is work that Aaron Debray did, and then Mason and Aaron as well.
So for the fermionic case, is the principle completely understood?
No. I would say for invertible states, yes, but more generally, it's been checked on a case-by-case basis. There's no, I don't think there's a...
Papers kind of have the general argument that it should always be true.
Sorry?
I mean, I think your papers kind of contain the general argument.
That I agree, but it hasn't been checked in the way that it has been for invertible states.
Yeah.
So it's believed to be true and complete, but it hasn't been checked in the way that it has been for invertible states.
I was not asking why it's true. I'm assuming it's true. I'm asking why the people know how to make the correspondence.
Oh, indeed. Yes. Yeah. That people know how to do. So, for example, in Aaron's work, if you want to start with some fractional quantum Hall system and enrich it with spatial symmetries. It's known how to encode the, how to go from the crystalline, to go from the crystalline symmetry on the fermionic system to some effective internal symmetry. That's understood. Any other questions? This one. So just a quick example in the fully general, in the interacting case, what this classification tells you, if you're in two spatial dimensions and you have translation symmetry, the classification essentially tells you that you get these different terms. So Q is the full topological classification. So Q2 is if you have some internal symmetry, it's just your two-dimensional system without any translation symmetry. So whatever you had in the absence of translation, that continues to be true because the symmetry protecting your state does not rely on translation symmetry. But then what you can also do is you can take lower dimensional SPT states, so 1D SPT states, and then stack them in a translation invariant way. And you can do that in two directions. So these are these lower dimensionally stacked translation SPTs. And then the last term is you can just take symmetry charges and then decorate your square lattice with those. And so the this is essentially encoding the Quinnoth formula here. So yeah, this has been looked at in great detail in a variety of different settings. So Ryan and Dominic had a table for just bosonic SPT phases in 2+1 dimensions with different space groups. And they gave the interact fully general interacting classification. For fermionic systems, it was worked by Chen Cheng Hu's group, where they also classified topological crystalline phases with different space group symmetries. And the classification is, you know, there's lots of different terms in here. So one gets a rich sort of invariance when we have these spatial symmetries. Okay. So we can also look at topologically ordered states and then enrich them with spatial symmetries. But in this case, there's no general classification because there's not a general classification of UMDCs. But the way one would approach this problem is you first fix your UMTC, so the topological order of the state that you're interested in, then enrich it with a symmetry, and then study it case by case. Okay. So recently there's been work by specifically by Mason's group on looking at abelian topologically ordered states, such as the fractional quantum Hall effect with the specific symmetry group. So there's U1 charge conservation or even Z2 fermion parity. And then the space group symmetry is translations and rotations. Sorry, that should be a Z squared. It's in two dimensions. So two translations, semi-direct rotations. And they take the crystalline equivalence principle as a given. So they write down a topological quantum field theory treating the crystalline gauge fields, essentially treating them as internal gauge fields. And they predict lattice versions of a certain continuum invariants that were known earlier, such as the shift, which I'll talk about. And then they also predict new invariants that are specific to the lattice that don't have a continuum analog. And this approach is powerful because you're not assuming anything about the system. It's a general interacting system, so it's non-perturbative. Okay. So here's the Lagrangian that one can write down, the TQFT one can write down for a system with z-squared translations and direct z-m rotations. I won't go into too much detail here. Here, a is a term that you should might be familiar. This is the usual Chen-Simons theory of abelian topological order. There's a fractional part, which encodes how the symmetry is fractionalized on the anions. And then you can also add on an SPT part on top. So yeah, this is the abelian DO. You have symmetry fractionalization data, and then you can add on the SPT data. So that's the general response theory. Now one could ask, I can write down this TQFT and these terms in the TQFT are quantized, they have quantized coefficients, but what do these invariants correspond to physically? And in certain cases, as I'll discuss now, these describe non-trivial bulk physics. So for example, this shift invariant encodes the quantized charge that's localized at a disclination defect. And then also one can ask what are the non-trivial boundary physics, if any, that are associated with these kinds of topological invariants. Okay. So let me look at a system now where I just have U1 charge conservation and U1 rotation symmetry or discrete rotation symmetry. where M will be 1, 2, 3, 4, 6. Although for quasicrystals, one could consider arbitrary. Yeah. Okay. So I start with the Lagrangian that I had before, and I integrate out the statistical gauge fields to get an effective response here of the system, where here A is some U1 background gauge field, omega is the spin connection. Here I'll only talk about the U1 subgroup, and I'll treat it as an internal symmetry. So one sees the ADA term. The AD omega term was called the Wen-Z term, discovered in 1992 by Wen and Z. And there's also an omega D omega term. So let me just go through these one by one. So the first term, the coefficient is just the Hawk inductance, the usual Chern-Simons term. S is known as the shift. This is the Wen-Z term. The third term, omega d omega, encodes the orbital angular momentum of the excitations. And then there's also the framing anomaly. So for this talk, I'm going to ignore the framing anomaly. I'll just, yeah, I'm going to set, ignore the last term. Okay, so that's the effective response theory. If we start with some generic non-invertible state, then these coefficients can take fractional values. As we know in the fractional quantum Hall effect, for example, at nu equals 1/3, sigma s minus 1 over 3, and s can also be fractional. If we have invertible states, then the Hall conductance takes integer values, or two terms integer values for bosonic systems, and the shift takes half integer or integer values, depending on if the theory you started with is fermionic or bosonic. Okay.
I mean, I looked at fractional values shouldn't be non-modifying, so you should really be keeping the topological diffusive freedom so that everything is quantized.
No, indeed. If these are fractional, then this is not really a well-defined closed manifold, but you can still use it as a probe of the system. Yeah, I agree. And one subtlety with the shift that is something that Naran and company have worked out is that on the lattice, this is only defined mod m, and it depends on the origin. So it has a, depending on where you place the origin in the unit cell, the shift changes. So this has been worked out in great detail in one of their papers. Okay, which is over there.
I guess the mod m part, other people have worked.
Right, the origin dependence. Yeah. Okay, so what's the physical interpretation of this term, the shift term? If I just take vary the action with respect to A naught, that should give me the particle density. And we see that there's a contribution from the shift, so it shifts the particle density. And one can also say that a U1 flux, if I vary the action with respect to omega naught, carries angular momentum. So if I imagine threading a flux through the system, I look at the many-body ground state, do this adiabatically, you would change the many-body momentum by an amount proportional to the shift. That also causes a spin current. Okay. So let me look at this term in a little more detail. And now I'll put the system on some arbitrary closed surface. So since omega is the spin connection, it's related to the curvature. And if I just evaluate the total charge, so the integral of the density, you see that there's a contribution coming from the shift that's proportional to the genus of the surface. So if I work on a torus versus a sphere, you see that there's 2 times S more charge on the sphere versus the torus. That's a signature of having a non-trivial S shift. So it's telling you that you have to fill more extra, more single particle states when you place a system on the surface of a sphere versus on a torus, if you want to keep the filling the same. Okay. So one example of this is just in continuum Landau levels. Take Landau levels, put them on a sphere, and you look and you see that for these integer quantum Hall states, the Hall conductance in the nth Landau level is just n. But if you want to fill C different Landau levels on the sphere, the total charge, you get a contribution that's proportional to the Chern number times the number of fluxes, total flux. And there's an extra contribution of C squared. So if I go back, we're supposed to get an extra contribution of 2S. So then we can identify the shift as C squared over 2. So if you fill C different Landau levels, then the total shift that you get is C squared over 2. And that tells you that the shift within the nth Landau level is just n plus a half. In the continuum, the shift is also related to the Hall viscosity, which was worked out by Reed in 2009. And it also implies a fractional charge that's bound to conical defects. So if you take your quantum Hall state, you cut out You put it on a disk and you cut out a little segment of it, you'll get a fractional charge that's bound to that disconnection defect. Okay. So now we move to the lattice. If you work on the lattice, then I can, instead of putting the system on the surface of a sphere, I can put the system on the surface of some platonic solid, which is homeomorphic to the sphere. And in this case, we should also get a 2 times S, excess charge compared to putting the system on a torus, keeping the filling fixed. And one can also show that this shift term associates a non-trivial fractional charge when you make an elementary disclination of 2 pi over m. So you take a lattice, you imagine cutting out a piece of it. So that's creating a 2 pi over 4 disclination defect in this case. You glue them back together in a prescribed way, and you'll see that on the disclination lattice, there's an excess charge localized around the disclination defect. Right. And the disclination charge in this case can take values s over m mod 1. So in work by Mason and Naren and company, they showed that if you take the Hofstadter model, you can add another color to it. So you can take the different parts of the butterfly, which had different churn number, and then decorate them further with the shift invariant, and it breaks up into these different sectors. And this has been done for different lattices, honeycomb, et cetera. Okay, so now the question that we wanted to ask was, is the non-trivial shift associated with any non-trivial edge physics? So if you have a non-trivial shift, can you protect edges? I should note that the Wen-Z term does not give you any non-trivial edge states. You get the edge states from having a non-trivial Hall conductance, but the non-trivial shift protects them. Okay. And so to show this, what I'll do is I'll consider two systems which have the same churn number but different shift invariants. And then as long as the total symmetry, charge conservation, and U1 rotation is conserved, we'll get counterpropagating edge modes, which cannot be gapped out. So here's the setup. I want to consider a bilayer system, where I imagine in the middle, we have a system with churn number 1 and shift 1/2. And on the outside, we have churn number 2 and shift 2. And on the second system, S2, we have churn number 1, S1/2. And on the outside, we have churn number 0, S equals 0. So when we stack these together, the total churn number is 2 on either side. But the shift differs by 1. So it's 1 in the interior and 2 in the exterior. And I won't worry about boundary conditions at infinity in this case. Okay. If you have a stack of these two integer quantum Hall states where the shift changes. So if I look at the first system by itself, since the churn number is jumping by 1, we must have some chiral edge modes localized at the interface. And on the second system, here the churn number is decreasing, and so we should have chiral edge modes that are counterpropagating. So if I stack these two systems together and the radii were the same for this interface, we would have two gapless counterpropagating edge modes. And generically, we should just be able to gap these out using local backscattering terms if we don't have rotation symmetry. Okay. So now let me go through this example. Any questions about the setup? Okay. So I'll work in the symmetric gauge to preserve rotation symmetry. So the Hamiltonian is the sum of two terms, particles in a magnetic field. And it's convenient to work in a basis of where n labels the Landau levels, is a Landau level index, m is another index, and m minus m, n will be the angular momentum index. We'll just write that in a second. So in this basis, you can see that A changes the Landau level index and B changes this other index M. The angular momentum just takes the simple form, B dagger B minus A dagger A in each system separately. And the kinetic energy part is just a harmonic oscillator term. Okay. So now we want to add a radial potential since I want to vary the churn number across the interface. And to do this, we'll just note that R squared conserves the angular momentum. So you can write it in terms of these A dagger and B operators, and you see that it doesn't change the action of R squared on these eigenstates, and an M doesn't change the angular momentum, which is just M minus N. So given any rotationally invariant potential, I can just diagonalize R squared first, and then express the potential in the basis, in this basis, for any radially symmetric potential, since it conserves the angular momentum. Okay. So this is the specific potential that we choose. So we'll put the vary the chemical potential across the interface in the following way. So for the first system, I take the chemical potential to be between the lowest and the first Landau level for R much less than the interface radius, capital R. And then as we go across, it'll cross the first, this at the first Landau level as well. So this will change the Chern number across the level from 1 to 2, which is what I indicated before. And since the shift is just related to the different number of Landau levels that you cross, the shift will also change across this interface. And the second one will go in the opposite way. So I'll go above the lowest Landau level and then vary the chemical potential so we're below it. So the Chern number becomes 0 in that case. Okay. Right. So for the radius being much less than R, only the lowest Landau level is below 0 energy in both S1 and S2. And for the radius R much greater than the interface, there are no Landau levels below 0 energy in the second system, and 2, both 0 and 1 for the first system. So this precisely gives us the setup that we wanted, where the shift is a half for both systems in the interior of the annulus, and then it differs in the exterior of the annulus. So here's the numerical results just for the non-interacting system. We just diagonalize the Hamiltonian and look at the energy spectra. So here the red curves are showing the eigenvalues of the first system and the blue for the second system. And we see that at zero energy, there are exactly these two counterpropagating edge nodes as expected. And so the question is, are these going to be protected once I start adding interactions into the system? Okay. So these two zero energy states, both are localized around this radius capital R, and each state has a well-defined angular momentum. If the angular momentum of these two states would be the same, then I could add a term that preserves rotation symmetry and break them out. But if they're localized at different angular momentum, then no rotationally symmetric term would have non-trivial matrix elements between them, and they couldn't be gapped out. Okay. So numerically, what we find is that if we want these two states to be localized at the same radius, their angular momentum differs by 2. So their difference is always proportional to the shift in this case. And so no radial potential could gap them out. But one could ask what happens if they're localized at slightly different radii. In that case, you can engineer the system such that they have the same angular momentum, but then their spatial separation is always greater than the magnetic length. And so no local but our interaction term can gap them out. So you can engineer the system so that they have the same angular momentum, but in that case, the separation ends up being too great, and there's no local term that you can add that can cap them out.
It's much greater than mean, exactly, because you would think there could be an exponentially small splitting in the...
Yeah, so let me get to that point, yeah. Okay, so here's one heuristic argument for why we expect these to be ungappable. So if I take the correlation length to be much smaller than the magnetic length, so I want to assume that my potential varies very slowly in this case. So there's no mixing between the Landau levels. In that case, I can associate a well-defined quantum number, M and N, with each of these edge states. So if I can do that, then one can just calculate using the expression of these in terms of the A and B dagger operators that the difference between the angular momentum between these two states is always minus 2, if I insist that they're at the same radius in this case. So that's one heuristic argument. But we can go beyond that. So I'll just solve the time-independent Schrodinger equation within the WKB approximation. So I'll work in radial coordinates and work in the large flux limit, which is the appropriate limit in the system. And in this case, I'll solve the eigenvalue problem. Take some convoluted form, but basically what this is saying is that we have exponentially localized chiral modes localized at these different radii, Ri and R1 and R2. And here N0 will be 1 for the first system, 1 for the first system, 0 for the second system. So on this plot, these dashed lines are exactly this WKB solution. So they match the numerics fairly well. If I look at the angular momentum of the zero modes, it takes the simple form. It's related to the radius at which they're localized. So going back there. So again, if I insist that the radius at which they're localized has to be the same, then their angular momentum cannot be the same. In that case, they couldn't be gapped out. But to address Dominic's question, let me assume that the angular momentum are the same, but the radius at which they're localized is not the same. In this case, we obtain the minimal separation between these edge states, so we can get them as the closest together we can get them is 4 times the magnetic length squared. And so if the wave function overlap between these states was to be non-zero at this separation, then we'd be able to gap them out using any local symmetric perturbation. But the wave function is related to these Hermite polynomials, and the crucial point is that the index n naught is different for these two wave functions. So it's 1 for the first system, 0 for the second system. This is related to the non-trivial shift. And because they have these different principal quantum numbers, you can show that this wave function overlap vanishes exponentially. So even if you arrange the system so that they have the same angular momentum, you get the minimal separation between them, one still can't gap these out because of this.
Is exponential in what?
In LB squared, magnetic mass squared. So they need to be closer than. So the overlap vanishes as the difference between. Let me see.
Like R1 minus R2 over
L squared, yeah, roughly like that. Yeah.
R1 minus R2 over L?
Yeah, over L. Yeah.
That's a finite number, right?
Well, as I make the system size larger.
What is R?
R is just the separation. I want to make the separation, between them as small as I possibly can. And the wave function overlap in this case, it decays as. It decays as a slope of the potential, if I remember correctly. So it depends on this length scale C that we had in the mechanical potential.
So the overlap, do you mean the overlap decreases to zero exponentially?
Yeah, it falls.
System size or
with with system size and as with the slope of this potential. So if I make the potential steeper, it vanishes faster. Yeah.
But in the thermodynamic limit, it's zero.
In the thermodynamic limit, it would be zero. Yeah. Okay. So the crucial point here was that this index n naught is different for these two systems, which comes from them having different shifts. And so if the shift on the inner side of the annulus and the outer side of the annulus is different, then these edge modes can't be gapped out by local symmetric perturbations, which is what we expect. But this argument was sort of not, it depended on the specific model that we considered and on microscopic details, as we saw. And so now we want to give a more general argument, which doesn't rely on any of these microscopic details. So I'll use Chun-Simons DQFT to study just generic interacting abelian topological orders with either continuous U1 symmetry or discrete U1 symmetry. And here we'll follow the crystalline equivalence principle and treat the rotation gauge field as being an internal gauge field.
Is the crystalline equivalence principle really a good thing to study boundaries? I have the impression that it's not really extending to the boundary physics.
So in this case, it does capture the correct boundary response. There is a subtlety that I can discuss offline. Yeah, that might be good to discuss. So the theory we want to start with is just an abelian Chun-Simons theory for abelian topological orders. K is some n by n symmetric integer matrix, which is invertible. It encodes the statistics of your bulk anions, and its determinant tells you the ground state degeneracy when you put it on an arbitrary manifold. Once we couple the system to global symmetries, the T and S vectors are the charge and spin vectors, respectively, so they tell us how what quantum numbers under U1 charge and U1 rotation symmetry the excitations, the anions carry. And here A again is a U1 background gauge field, and then omega will also be a U1 background gauge field.
So can you explain what omega is again?
Yeah, so here omega is the gauge field for spin rotation, U1 power spin rotation symmetry. So more generally, it should be the spin connection. Here I'll just focus on the U1 subgroup.
So it's just a U1 gauge field?
It's just a U1 gauge field.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Right, or a ZN gauge field when I go to the discrete case.
Oh, it seems to be coupling to the same as AMU, capital AMU. What's the difference between the two connections?
No, here there are just two separate U1 gauge fields. One is for charge conservation, one is for rotation.
They're coupling to d nu a lambda I. It's the same, they're just coupling to the same thing.
Right, so one is telling you that the anions carry fractional charge, and the other is telling you that they carry fractional spin. And so these vectors T and S just encode the charge and spin quantum numbers.
Okay.
Yeah. So we can integrate out the statistical gauge fields and get the effective response theory as we did before, in which case the Hall conductance would just be given by TK inverse T, so it's encoded in the charge vector. The shift is SK inverse T, and then this other coefficient L sub S is SK inverse S. So for the toric code, K is just 2 times sigma X, for instance. Okay. So in the bulk, we can label our quasi-particles with some integer vectors. So I'll use L. And the self-statistics of these quasi-particles, theta L, are just given. Again, they're encoded in these L vectors and the K matrix. The mutual statistics are also encoded in these L vectors and the K matrix. And the system should, of course, support the local microscopic degrees of freedom that we started with. And so those are labeled by these L vectors, K times L. So now let me go to the edge. So this is standard, nothing new here. We just take our abelian Chen-Simons theory, and typically one puts it on a slab, but in this case I'll put it on a disk, so we'll work in polar coordinates. Theta will label the edge in this case. And the edge theory, we have these different bosons which satisfy the standard Kac-Moody algebra. The charge density is just, again, labeled by this integer vector T times partial of phi. And then the spin angular momentum density on the edge is captured by this integer vector S. Okay. And so for every quasi-particle in the bulk, there's an analogous edge quasi-particle, which is labeled again by these L vectors and these fields phi. Okay. And one important point is that all of the local excitations on the edge that come from having the local bosonic particles in the bulk are generated by these N independent local excitations. We can look at how these edge operators transform under the symmetries. So under a U1 phase rotation by the U1 charge conserving symmetry, they transform in this way, from which we can read off that the charge of the edge excitation is L, the vector characterizing the quasi-particle up to, again, encoded in this charge vector T. So L K inverse T encodes the charge of this excitation. And then similarly, the angular momentum of the excitation is encoded in L K inverse S, opposite of the integer N. Okay. So this is maybe where the subtlety with treating this as an internal symmetry comes in. Let me go back. Because this transforms as a translation on the edge. So that's where the subtlety would come in. Yeah. Okay. So as pointed out by Haldane and then again by Levin in 2013, given some abelian Chen-Simons theory, we can always condense local bosonic degrees of freedom in the bulk, and this should not change the topological order in the system. And on the boundary, this means that there's certain backscattering, or these are also called Higgs terms, that we can add.
In the discrete case, it's actually like a very big translation, right? Should be allowed to write local terms that break the symmetry.
I'll get to the discrete case, and you will be able to gap these out in the discrete case, the edge modes, but you won't be able to gap out the quantum modes. So basically, be the Right. Okay. So the system has a net chirality. There's more right movers than left movers. And of course, not all the edge modes can be capped out. We can't cap out chiral modes. But if the signature of the K matrix is trivial, so we have equal number of left movers and right movers, then we can potentially gap out the edge states of an abelian Chern-Simons theory. And so the criteria that Levin put forward is basically there should be a Lagrangian subgroup. Lagrangian subgroup is a set of integer vectors m such that they all have trivial braiding with themselves and amongst each other. So mk inverse m should be 0 for all m in this set m. And then for any other quasiparticle, it should either belong to the Lagrangian subgroup or it should braid non-trivially with at least one element of the Lagrangian subgroup. So that's the criteria. And if you can find such a Lagrangian subgroup for your given abelian DO, then you can gap out the edge. So one counterexample, okay, I'll write that down in just a second. Yeah, so if you had 0 to 0, so for the toric good, you can gap out these edge modes. But if you had 0, 3, minus 5, 0, then Levin showed that even in the absence of any symmetry, you can't gap out these edge modes because you can't find a good Lagrangian, you can't find a single Lagrangian subalgebra. So this gives a sufficient condition, necessary sufficient condition for when you can and cannot gap out edge modes of an abelian DO. Okay. So what it means to condense, physically what it means by adding these terms is that you're condensing these local bosons on the edge, which means they have long-range correlations on a gapped edge. And we can explicitly add these backscattering terms to the edge theory that we started with, where this function f is some smooth function around the boundary, except at corners where it can jump. And these vectors lambda have to satisfy this null vector condition. The null vector condition basically means if I have two sets of counterpropagating edge modes, I can rotate them so that I can form a single chiral, a non-chiral Luttinger liquid, which can then be gapped out by local terms. So here's an example of a simple model with an ungappable edge. Okay, but once we add symmetries to the story, now you have additional constraints instead of just a Lagrangian algebra condition, subgroup condition. In this case, the condensable bosons have to be charge neutral. If they're not charge neutral, then you would have symmetry breaking on the edge. So let me assume first that we have just charge conservation, and I'll assume that we have a symmetric gap boundary. So assuming that I have a symmetric gap boundary means that the charge operators should have short-range correlation functions. So this means that these M vectors have to be charge neutral. MK inverse T should be 0. Now let me suppose that the Hall conductance is fractional. So TK inverse T is non-zero. If I make this assumption, essentially you see that this contradicts the Lagrangian subgroup assumption that I made when I assumed that I have a symmetric gap boundary. Because if TK inverse is non-zero, then T can't belong to this Lagrangian subgroup M, because every element of that should braid trivially with itself and every other element of the subgroup. And then charge neutrality means that T braids trivially with all elements of the Lagrangian subgroup. So one of these has to be violated, and we don't have a good Lagrangian subgroup. So having a non-trivial fractional Hall conductance gives a sufficient condition for having a gapless edge mode, which should not be a surprise. And now we can make a similar argument for having this U1 rotation symmetry and essentially show that if we have a non-trivial shift invariant, then again, you can't gap out these edge modes. Okay. But one point about this Lagrangian subgroup argument is that it only picks up the fractional part. So there's this mod 1 that's sitting here, which we want to get rid of, because of course we know that in a Chern insulator with where sigma xy is non-zero, we can't gap out the chiral edge mode. Whereas this argument would say that you can, so we're missing something. Okay. So we can make this argument using Oshikawa's flux threading approach. So I'll take the system, put it on a disk, imagine threading a flux of U1 or U1 rotation symmetry, and then show that the assumption of a unique symmetric ground state gives a contradiction. Okay. So let me assume I have a gapped symmetric edge and then show a contradiction. I'm assuming gap symmetric edge, which means I can add some local terms to my Hamiltonian, which gap it out, which take this form. Let me not go into details. And now imagine threading a flux through the system. So I'm threading some flux phi through the system. And I can undo this using a large gauge transformation, which is this U0. And what this means is that the Hamiltonian with no flux inserted has the same spectrum as that once I've inserted this flux, because of course there's a large gauge transformation, the spectrum shouldn't change. And since I'm assuming that the system has a gap, or equivalently that the low energy description is basically that of these edge states on the boundary of the disk, the ground state will just follow along as I do this adiabatic evolution, and it'll come back, it'll change by at most a phase. So that's what this relation means over here. But the charge of the system changes when I do this U1 flux insertion, which means the ground state before flux insertion and after flux insertion carry different charge, which means I can't have a stable, I can't have a symmetric gapped edge in this case. Right. So, so using the flux threading argument, we can refine the previous argument and say that any a non-zero Hall conductance means a stable gapless edge. Okay. And then you can also show that the angular momentum changes during this flux threading process. And so a non-trivial shift also implies a stable gapless edge. Okay. So the part that I'm going to not going to do much detail, because this is where the subtlety with treating this as an internal symmetry shows up. One can imagine threading a flux of this U1 rotation gauge field, but that acts not mixes space and time non-trivially because it acts as a translation on the boundary. But one can still argue that this S gain versus S also implies a stable gapless edge. But let me not dwell on that. Okay. So here are necessary and sufficient conditions for having a symmetric gapped edge in a generic abelian topological order with U1 symmetry and U1 rotation symmetry. So all of these coefficients have to be non-zero. And so the previous example of the quantum Hall effect, where we had to rely on microscopic arguments, in this case, we can use these general field theory arguments to show that indeed the edge states should be robust in that setup where we have these counterpropagating edge modes. And they can't be gapped without breaking U1. Okay.
You got over 10 minutes.
Okay. Okay, so now let me put the system not on a disk, but on some regular n-sided polygon, some n-gon. And let me assume first that the Hall conductance is zero. And so in this case, the counterpropagating edge modes can be symmetrically gapped out. So everywhere on this edge, we can just gap out these edge modes using local symmetric terms.
You're assuming here that you have the Zn rotation symmetry.
I will keep a Zn rotation symmetry,
So I mean, your statement, if you made the boundary a disk, I mean, you would still have the same statements, right? Because it's coming from the symmetry.
No, I don't quite follow. So if you only have a Zn symmetry, you can add local terms now that will gap out your edge modes everywhere except for the corners.
Yeah, but it doesn't have to be at the corners, right? I mean.
Oh, no, indeed. Oh, I see what you're saying. So even if you put the system on a disk, they would be sort of smeared out. In that case, you wouldn't be able to pinpoint exactly where that excess charge was. I don't know where this, as you start deforming this corner mode, it would not be precisely localized at a single point. Yeah. So it's more convenient to work on a polygon in this case. But I agree. Right, so everywhere on the edge of the polygon, we've now gapped out these edge modes. But if you look at the vertex operators, so the operators corresponding to excitations of the corners of this polygon, they carry a corner localized charge, which is proportional to the shift again. So it's S over N mod 1 in this case. Okay, so that was the case where we just took the system and we put it on a flat 2D surface.
One of those systems and added a few impurities away from the corners.
Right.
So that you don't have exact Zn symmetry anymore. Would this still be stable?
That's a good question. So the recent work on, I'm not sure, but at least for non-interacting higher order TIs, when you add disorder to the system, such that the disorder still retains the spatial symmetry on average, you still see these common localizations. So work by Chong, for instance, on these average SPTs, that would suggest that you would still see that, as long as the disorder still preserves the symmetry on average. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So I think you would still see them.
So now let me take the system, and I'm now going to put it on the surface of some platonic solid, which is homeomorphic to the sphere. So you can kind of guess the answer in this case before we even begin. Okay. So we have five of these in this case. The faces of these solids are regular n-gons, and then m different faces share a vertex in this case. And so for the square, three different faces share a vertex. And the Euler characteristic of these polygons is, of these platonic solids, is 2, which is what it should be since these are homeomorphic to a sphere. And then we can just calculate. So if I look at how many vertices I have, it's given by this equation over here. And so since the excess charge should be 2s, and that should be spread out symmetrically over these vertices, the excess charge should just be 2s over the number of vertices. So this is the result that we expect just based on the continuum argument. But let me reproduce that using the field theory. And I should note that this argument no longer relies on having the Hall conductance being 0. So here we can work with just arbitrary abelian TOs with non-vanishing Hall conductance, whereas when I put the system, when I wanted to make the Kahn-Mohr argument on a flat surface, I had to assume a vanishing Hall conductance. In this case, we don't need to make that assumption. Okay. So the way the field theory argument works is as following. We'll just take our system, put it on a flat surface to begin with, and I'll break it up into these four, for example, for the square or for the cube, I'll break it up into these four different segments. And at first, if I'm not putting the system on a surface of a sphere or a cube, for instance, then I should be able to just sew all of these together, and there should be no localized mode at the vertex where these are all joined together, because I'm just putting on a flat system. Okay. So you can work through these arguments. You can write down a gapping term for these edge modes, such that the chiral bosons on these different edges are pinned to each other. And then looking at how they transform on the CN symmetry, you can show that in this case, the localized charge at the vertex where these all join together is indeed 0, as it should be. So I can just sew these back together into a smooth state. But now I want to put this on a surface of a cube. Essentially, what we're doing is we're cutting out this one square and then rotating this, doing a pi over 2 rotation, and then sewing those together. So this edge must now be sewed together with that, with force. 3 must be sewed together with 1 in this case. And you can do this in general for any of these platonic solids. And that's basically forming the corner of the cube in this case. Okay. So in this case, if you want to sew these together properly and add a symmetric perturbation to the system, you have to modify the gapping term. And once you do that and you go through the arguments, you'll reproduce the expected corner charge. So the charge localized at each corner is indeed 2s over v, where it's related to these to n and m, which is the number of n-sided polygons that are sewed together at a vertex together. So for all these different platonic solids, we can just calculate what the corner charge is in each case. And one observation is that the charge localized at the corner of a platonic solid is the same as making a disclination defect on a plane. Right. So this is exactly the same as cutting out this part and gluing that together. If I kept it on a flat surface, that's basically like making a disclination, or I could put it on the corner of a cube. Okay.
So how much time? 5 minutes.
Okay, I'll just go over this quickly. Okay, so that's sort of the end of the corner charge story. The upshot is that if you preserve U1 symmetry, rotation symmetry, and U1 charge symmetry, then you have these counterpropagating edge modes that you can't gap out in generic interacting abelian topological orders. And if you put the system on the surface of a cube or some other platonic solid, then you get these common localized charges. So one thing I'll quickly mention is how one actually calculates the shift in some given many-body system. So there's recent work by Naran and then earlier work by Shinsei and company, where they calculate this shift invariant given some many-body ground state using partial rotation operators. But there's also a way of calculating these indices using so-called many-body RSIs. So in this case, one has to define quantum numbers in such a way that the Noether charges are independent of the boundary conditions. Let me say what I mean specifically. So I want to assume some many-body state. And I define the state on some region R. The state is generated by this operator O. So I'm assuming that I have a many-body non-trivial topological state, by which I mean that it's not trivially connected to an atomic limit, a many-body atomic limit. So if you make this assumption, you can ask, are there operators that I can define such that their eigenvalues are invariant of how I make this boundary truncation? So independent of how I truncate this region R. So for example, if I had inversion symmetry, just looking at the quantum numbers of these many-body ground states, GS on R and R prime would be different. But if I look at the quantum numbers of these specific combinations of operators, so e to the I pi over 2, n is the number operator, I is the inversion operator, you can prove that these are independent of the boundary truncation on open boundary conditions. So these give you good many-body invariants. And this is work done with Jonah and Andre Bernovig at Princeton. And we can show that for CN rotation symmetry, the specific many-body invariants that one should look at are these two numbers. So CN times the C1 part and then CN squared, which are related to delta 1 and delta 2, which we call many-body RSIs. And these have the correct quantization. So for n even, so m equals 2, 4, or 6, delta 1 and delta 2 take values in z2n cross zn over 2, which reproduces the field theory result that Naran and Mason had using g cross Braille tensor categories. And for n odd, we get zn cross zn classification for these many-body RSIs. And we have a prescription for turning these into the shift. So 2 times delta 1 minus delta 2 is what we show gives a shift. Okay. So with that, I'll end the talk. And there's a few things that could be interesting to look at, which is generalizing our arguments in non-abelian topological orders. In general, you could have non-abelian corner states if you have a CN rotation symmetry that permutes anion types instead of just acting in the way that we assumed. And then one interesting observation is that there are other terms in this topological field theory that one writes down, which I didn't consider here, which correspond to having a non-trivial polarization. So one problem that's been well known is that the polarization is not well defined if you have a non-trivial Chern number in the system. And so there's no good way to identify it. But from using these kinds of arguments, where we took two systems with the same Chern number but different shift, we were able to get an indicator of that. So we could now imagine having a system where we take the system, it has the same Chern number on two sides, and we make an interface where the polarization is different. So while the polarization is not well-defined, the difference in polarization still is. And that would be a well-defined invariant that one could calculate. OK, with that, my collaborators, and stop.
So for the corner charge in the, can you go to the slide where you have the high cone with the corner charges?
Yeah.
If I now put up one of the six corners, what happens to all the six corners? Hmm.
When you say put up, you mean you want to break, you want to keep the symmetries?
And put up only one of the six. So I'm not weak.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. So the symmetry will be
good. Yeah, if you only put up one of the corners, then you can move the state around. You'd have this state localized in this zero energy state in the middle of your spectrum. And if you added a perturbation that acts in a non-symmetric manner, then you'd be able to move this charge around.
If I just put up one of the corners where the other corner charge is bigger.
That's a good
I mean, it can't be, right? Because it should only depend locally on what locally.
Yeah, since it's a only doing a local operation, then yeah, but you'd be able to move this one charge off, in this case, into the bulk of the spectrum.
So I don't, so I'm breaking the symmetry. Some of the charges are still there.
In this specific instance, yeah, where you apply a local perturbation that only acts near one, yes, in that case you would get rid of that single corner charge only. But if you added some generic rotation symmetry, this is an interesting, an interesting question. So one thing we recently tried is we took the Hofstadter model, which has C6 symmetry, and that's predicted to have half corner charge or disclination charge. And we explicitly broke the C6 symmetry and reduced it to C3. And we were not able to change the shift invariant in this case. So it's we don't fully understand that. So taking a system with C6 and breaking it down to C3, the invariant didn't change. At least numerically, we're not able to observe any kind of a spectral flow that would change this invariant. So that's all.
Which invariant? I thought the invariant here is defined after you define the symmetry.
Right, but suppose I take a system which has C6 symmetry and I have a well-defined shift. Right, and I break it down, now explicitly break it to C3. So one would expect that the quantized charge should change in some way. But it doesn't seem that one can do that by adding these local perturbations. Yeah. So somehow once you've defined it for a C6 system, it stays the same even when you break it down to a C3 system. Yeah. That's a numerical observation at this point, yeah.
Do you break it on the boundary or on the bulk?
Explicitly in the bulk. Yeah.
Slightly unrelated question. Is there any, so you mentioned that one of the reasons why this topological order or symmetric topological orders are useful is for quantum information tasks.
Mm-hmm.
Is there any way like this application of these space-time symmetric enriched topological orders can have any applications for enhanced quantum information tasks?
That's a good question. I haven't thought about it. So that really comes down to the structure of entanglement in the ground state. And so if you start with a topologically ordered state, then its ground state space gives you a code space to begin with. I don't know what adding extra symmetries on top would do in that particular situation. I'm not sure.
If you have a state that has charge fractionalization, so the anions carry fractional charge, and you can imagine just building a higher order topological insulator but out of the fractional charges. So is this the same as that, or is it different from that, these invariants that we discussed?
This is the same as that. Basically, yeah, it's an instance of a fractional higher order DI. Say it like that. Yeah.
Are there invariants that have like rotationally symmetric phases that cannot be thought of in that way?
Oh. No, I don't know. I think all the instances I know, at least in this case. They would always have this interpretation of having some fractional charge, localized. Yeah. It's an interesting question if there's a counterexample to that. Yeah.
But in this type of analogy.